I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the James Donald Forbes McCann Catamaran Plan. If you'd like to listen to bonus episodes, go sign up to the Patreon. That's patreon.com. Anyway, you'll find a way.
Don't panic, the podcast is not going to sound like this. I'm recording this straight to my laptop. I've lost all my podcasting equipment. But before I lost all my podcasting equipment, and that's a story you'll get in the future. Before I lost the podcast equipment, I recorded this podcast. It's coming up with Mark Barnes. We had a beautiful chat. Mark lives in Steubenville, Ohio. He's very brilliant. He's a great writer. And I note that he's giving two talks in Adelaide. So, Wednesday, July 16th at 7 p.m, you can hear him at Earn Mally in a speech entitled Against Cars, Consultants, Stocks, Dishwashers, and Drones in a Q&A. And then he's also giving a talk Tuesday, July 15th, which I think is today, the day this comes out in Australia, at the... Where is it now? It's at the Church of the Holy Name. There we go. It's in the hall at Holy Name. And that's on the family tradition and rebuilding Christian community. So if you want to see a Catholic talk or a secular talk, you can go. That one that's on July 15th is at 7 p.m. at Holy Name Church in Adelaide. The other one is at Earn Mally at 7 p.m. on Wednesday. Yes. All right. Now you can stop listening to this. It's a very appalling sound quality. And here is me talking to Mark Barnes.
I had a nap. And I've woken up, I think, better than I went down, which is always a risk.
You slept like a big baby. I got to see you. I was writing while you were napping. And I think that a large Australian napping nearby is going to become an essential part of the process for me, because I really did
it's
well.
A huge part of our economy moving forward is being napping near people. You got two essays done. You got the air conditioning essay.
Yeah.
I've forgotten in my waking up haze what the other essay was about.
It was about being a professor in the age of AI cheating.
For or against?
Both.
You're often against things. You're not in real... Now, hold on. There's essayist Mark and there's having a chat Mark, because the essays are usually... Not usually, but the ones that stay with me, I remember several instances of, here's something I bet you think you can do. Well, guess again, you can't be doing that. And I love that. It's surprising, great invective. And then in real life, I think you have a more permissive disposition to entertaining things.
Yeah.
But I think maybe only...
Well, look, James, that's just...
Am I being unfair?
No, it's a phenomenon of writing. When everything is going well, I don't think, let's write something. It's only the things... Dostoevsky wrote what I think is his finest, Demons.
It's his... Really, you think Demons is number one?
Well, I mean, there's number one and there's number one. I mean, obviously, Crime and Punishment is the best novel, as novel.
Well, see, I agree with that, but the Karamazov people want to...
It's an unfinished.
I love The Idiot. I'm a big The Idiot fan.
But in terms of just raw...
When he's trying to kill himself and he can't do it right?
Yeah, actually.
When the money goes in the fireplace? Come on, man.
Having epileptic fits looking at Crowded Christ?
That's... Sometimes you got to choose between a lady who doesn't want you and money in a fire, and all you can do is have an epileptic fit. We've all been there.
But Demons was written in a fury. And it really, Dostoevsky's, I think what makes him great is that he always wrote when he was angry. He always had a point to make. He was didactic. He was grumpy, and he would be against the nihilists. He'd be against the atheists, and he'd write a novel. Now, I don't write a novel. I write an essay, but I think the same Wait, that sounds really arrogant. I don't mean to say I'm the Dostoevsky of essay writing. I just mean to say that anger is a motivator.
I think considering some of the things happening in his private life, if anything, you lower yourself to say that you're a Dostoevsky. My favorite Dostoevsky story is the degenerate gambling.
Yeah,
is
right.
I read this in a book about gambling. I haven't seen it anywhere else. But he apparently wrote in a letter to somebody that he sat down at the roulette table. Mm-hmm. He lost everything. Mm-hmm. And upon losing everything, he spontaneously ejaculated.
Oh, no.
But it was like such a relief that he, without friction, emitted.
Yeah, that follows. Girard on Dostoevsky says that the man was really about a process of conversion. Like he wasn't writing novels because he was a great novelist. He was writing because he was a man who was spiritually struggling to become Christian.
Yes.
And through a route of immense mimetic rivalry and envy and nihilism, and so he kind of wrote it all out. So just to say, he wrote The Gambler after presumably that experience. So there was also some other fruit that was more fruitful.
I mean, the quote they love
from the experience,
dredging up for him in literature courses, is between Christ and the truth, I choose Christ.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is really, it's not really the message of. Christ doesn't come and say, I have my bag of lies now. You know, he's struggling. He's really. And then you've got to disregard the end of Crime and Punishment. Because I don't know how many arguments like that I had in university with people going, Crime and Punishment is great until The Coda. Oh, I loved The Coda. I think The Coda was more than anything made me was the event that I pinpoint as going, I have to become a Christian.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're onto something, which is that. So. People listen to this podcast, right?
I mean, sometimes.
Okay, so for those who don't know, Crime and Punishment ends with what gets critiqued as just a happy ending of Christianity.
Yeah.
Comes in and just makes
it better. The
punishment
section.
Yeah. He gets punished by going to prison and he becomes Christian. I mean,
it's one sliver back from that. All the ingredients are there, such that it's so lovely. And they go, well, it's all prepared for him to have his conversion. And then they go, but that is another story.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about that, but it's so beautifully done.
That's because Dostoevsky really is a Christian. I mean, he really does transcend the literary hope and salvation, which is that you can be happy simply by virtue of writing pretty books. And he actually says, no, I'm going to become an apologist for a religion at the end. And it's like, whoa, there goes the aesthetic thing. It's like, you're right. There it goes.
It's Christ coming in over the... But he really captures the suffering of it. And I sort of... This is maybe a personal problem. But I think if you're writing on pornography... Mark is an outstanding writer on pornography.
This is your writing on pornography.
You've written extensively on pornography, but there is a real difference between the way you're writing on pornography and its issues and how to live without pornography and what that life looks like versus, I think, other griftier people in that sphere whose writing seems to bear no... I read their writing and I think, wow, that's a good guy, but it just has nothing. I mean, we came into the hotel room and the first thing you said was something like, gee, aren't hotels very sexually depraved?
Yeah, they are a hotel.
Don't you feel, you said something like, don't you feel a weird sexual anxiety being in a hotel? It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Every time, a huge wave of it.
Hotels, as hotels, are near occasions of sin.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is
well, and why? But you know, because
it's undeniably so.
Yeah. So obviously, there's like an associative aspect. The hotel is the promise of anonymity, right? So you are entering into a room that is not a home.
Yes.
It has the bed, which is of course the symbol of homemaking, including the act of lovemaking. But then it is an anonymous bed, right? Which is the symbolic definition of prostitution, right? The woman. Say that you treat as wife who is not
no,
wife.
No, I appreciate
who's not wife.
Little guy dig. Please go on.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to be open to other
yeah
possible prostitutions. And that I think afflicts man, because we are symbolic creatures. You don't get, you can pretend you're not, but you are.
Yes.
And a bed in an anonymous place is itself an incitement to lust. It is a sign of loneliness, right? And loneliness is properly understood as a lack of communion with the other. And sex is one of the, because it is a form of communion, but it's also a form of communion that's very easy for us to believe is like within our control. It's like I can.
I mean, we certainly desperately want to think that it is.
Well, you see this all the time. I mean, it explains a lot of perversions, right? That you have that often the feeling of being alienated from a phenomenon, sex steps in as a way of regaining lost communion over it. I see this a lot with like the sexualization of childhood. Often people think that, you know, things become pervy over time. Disney becomes pervy over time because, I don't know, they don't necessarily give a direct reason besides just the corruption of the world in general. But actually, I think it's because intense relationships of belonging to cartoon characters, to places and people becomes disappointing as you become an adult. You don't actually get the world that you were delivered on TV. You don't get the fictional world.
And you want to juice it up with some extra.
Well, it's not just juicing it up. It's actually trying to retrieve it. Like something, I mean, think about the amount of fan fiction that's pornographic. Why? Because it seems like, at least on a rational, if we're just going to guess, it's like, shouldn't there be about the same amount of regular fan fiction as there is pornographic fan fiction? But in fact, it seems like a chief motivator for the existence of fan fiction at all is the pornographizing of,
well, I would say
accounts.
Two of the biggest media franchises of the 2010s are both essentially erotic, pornographic. You have 50 Shades of Grey,
right, of course,
which is a sexualized Twilight, and it starts out as a fan fiction of that. And the entire work of Game of Thrones is sexualized. He's just putting sex into Lord of the Rings where sex was not.
Right.
And it must be said, Lord of the Rings is a weirdly non-sexual, it really disregards that dimension entirely. And there is something, I mean, there's got to be a happy medium point in where it's not.
James just wants a little sex.
Well, I think back to all the women in Lord of the Rings, and to be a world without sex, it sort of has to be a world without women.
It's true, but there is a difficulty that they tried to solve in The Hobbit, where a lot of the women and men belong to different kinds of creatures.
Yes.
And well, they tried to solve that in The Hobbit by having a dwarf fall in love with an elf, and it seemed
wrong. This is in the cinematographic version.
In the movie, yeah.
I'm still trying to inject that.
But just to finish the thought, because a thought should be finished.
Yes.
You
believe that, but go on.
No, I think that's true. The hotel room has this effect because we're symbolic creatures. So you can't just tell people to wear a mask for a year without also bringing in the image of mask wearing as criminality, as being suspicious. In a similar way, you can't simply live in an anonymous room that is like but not like a home, I think, without the loneliness, lack of communion, as that's the symbol you're entering into. And then sex appears as a relief from that lack of communion, because that's very often what sex does. Sex seems to be can be used as a means for establishing community, or really, I think, faking
sex is
communion. That's not there.
However, one must travel sometimes.
Yeah, not sure.
Not everybody. Some people, they get to live in a hermitage type.
James, stuff. I get it. You've got a life to defend. Go ahead.
What is the practical means forward of being able to be in a place? And what would be a better way to live in a place? I once stayed at a pub.
Cool. How'd it go?
Filthy.
Yeah.
But great.
But chaste.
It was quite nice to be in a place that during the day, you know, just downstairs, people having pints. And all pubs, I think, were like this at one point, public houses. But it really felt more like a third space rather than a pseudo first space.
Yeah, and then I think lust very often operates when you're lonely, and pubs seem to at least be already working against loneliness.
Yes.
I'm not saying that it couldn't be.
I mean, it must be said, I think it hostels the the loneliness is decreased, but the opportunity for
Sure. No. I mean, there's there's always many near occasions of sin. It's just, yeah. They're not all the same, right?
Yes.
Now, what strikes me about our society is that sex becomes a very grasping, medicinal sort of sin. Like we're trying to heal ourselves with it, as Marvin Gaye would say. But it's not like the lusty, look at this bar wench who not also a near occasion.
It's
of
an
sin,
entirely is, into. It's a relief of anxiety more than a desire for the other.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking about why
there are some sins that are better than others.
Yes. Certainly the sins against nature further down in hell than lust, you know, loving too much and in the wrong direction.
Sure.
I don't know how many gay churches I have seen in America and England and Australia at this point. Not one gay mosque, but so many trans flags outside of Episcopalian churches. My favorite one that I ever saw was in Auckland. There was a big sign out front. It said, all is welcome. And it was a gay thing. And it was the ark. And it was the animals marching up the ark, two by two. But it was obviously the same gendered animals. There were two lions with manes.
Very
quickly you go, well, what will that do for the future of lions when they come off of that ark? This falls apart immediately.
Is this true?
Yes.
Wow.
I remember it was several years ago in Auckland. I'm having a weird... I haven't been back to Pittsburgh in some time.
Pittsburgh.
And it's lived very large in my memory. And this is the first place.
We're in a sort of development by the river. I think I don't know if we're by the Ohio or the Monongahela. But we're at the riverfront.
And then they merge into
they become one big mess and then they become another river, I think.
Eventually they become the ocean.
It's a beautiful city.
I went to LA the first time I came to America, and I wandered around Inglewood for a while, and it was very fun and very strange, and Venice Beach. But then the first place I spent any serious time was Steubenville, and Pittsburgh, of course, being in the greater Steubenville economic zone.
That's right.
But I got to come through that airport that I've just gone back to.
Yes.
And that really inside of me has been, and it's this weird. You go to a new place, and it's a place that everyone around there thinks is crummy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's new, and so all the things about... It has all these virtues that people have become blind and numb to. Mm-hmm. So the Pittsburgh airport, people go, I hate the Pittsburgh airport. Yeah, blah, blah. It's like very 90s. And I remember my first time seeing it, I think the first time I was in your car when you picked me up, taking me from on a very cold winter morning, I was raving about how much I... loved the airport, and this is strange because it's dark, it's unusual. There's a train that seems kind of pointless there, and they're now updating it, which is breaking my heart. But I now see it having. That was the first proper American airport that I walked around in, and now I see it having seen 60 or 70 American airports.
Yeah,
and it is dark, and it is strange, and it does have. I still love what I saw about it to begin with, but I can't help now but see it not as the American things about it that really buoyed me are gone. In becoming more American and being here for longer, I can't see the American things. I can only see the Pittsburgh things about it. I'm getting somewhere. I don't know how to... And this is sort of disenchanting. Like, I walk around. It's a very hot day, and it's been very dusty. But the bridges seem less yellow to me somehow. They're so yellow in my mind. I see them now. They're pretty yellow. But they're not, they're not that same yellow that they once were.
Yeah.
And the airport, I go, I do think we could clean this place. Let's get a broom going through here.
Yeah.
And I do think, when I saw the big fat people of Pittsburgh, the weird... That Appalachian, that real Appalachian thing. I was so charmed by it, and so pleased by it. And now I think, good Lord, what are we? Let's brush our teeth.
Yeah, tattoo there. Yeah. No, I mean, look, creatures of comparison. I mean, there's no denying it. This is one of the problems with our society is that we have too many comparisons to make.
We can't help it. I've become a rootless cosmopolitan.
Look
in this
at
country.
You. You're the global financial class.
It makes me feel...
You come from everywhere and nowhere. You're at home everywhere and nowhere. You're homeless.
But never homeless.
But never homeless. Because the world is your anti-home.
This is a... I'm in exile. This is a temporary exile. Yes. And we only rest in God.
Well, that's convenient.
Yes. It's my anti-nationalist argument. I am a nationalist, but in heaven.
We're making this place a strip mall because our only home is heaven. I think I've heard this argument from the evangelical Republicans for a while. It's like, yeah, Walmart, Costco, box store, highway, paradise. It's a boring, awful paradise.
This is a hair shirt.
It's
that
just,
we must wear.
You know, in heaven, that's when the good stuff happens. No worry. Don't try to do things here. Don't cry about it. It's all going to be great. I think this is foolish. It's foolish for several reasons. I mean, if earth is preparatory for heaven,
yeah,
then you are slowly building up, whether you like it or not, your expectation of box stores as
heaven.
Heaven. Right? You can't just sort of undo the habits that it's forming in you.
Oh, there will be no Costco in heaven.
No, there won't.
But I will be very upset if there's not a Home Depot.
No, there's nothing. There's nothing.
Well, there's everything.
Every man under his fig tree. And I presume every man has his own little Home Depot.
Well, someone has to tend to the fig trees. I don't understand how time doesn't work in heaven.
Oh, I think it does.
Well, I'm interested.
I think people get confused about the difference between
time without
God
change?
And heaven.
Okay.
Right? And God is in his heaven. It's a world. But it's a world that's populated. I mean,
so we're still
angels,
breathing,
saints.
Around.
I mean, how are you going to conceive of...
Well, they sing.
How are you going to conceive of singing without time? How are you going to move from do to re? Never mind re to mi.
It's just one big chromatic chord going on forever.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I think you know, the human person, you know...
Will be sophisticated enough to understand it.
He's a subject, and so he makes time wherever he goes. That's what he does.
But it will have no end. I mean, how can it have no end if it has no time?
I think it can have no end and have succession.
One thing
to the next. Why?
Now, have you seen Severance?
I've not, but I also haven't seen anything.
No, I was going to say, I was going to caveat that with, I don't know someone with more cultural impact who's keeps up with the culture less, and I respect that, and I would that was the case for me.
Oh, I think it's the only... In some ways, it's a selfish response. Sometimes people ask me, how do you do so much? Which is embarrassing to me because I do many things badly. And so they don't know that necessarily because they often are on the sort of more superficial like list of things I do.
Yes.
But I do think there's a...
I remember a... as landlord.
Yes.
There when a bit of roof fell down... And I remember seeing the plastering at the edge just before we left.
Yeah.
What happened to the plastering? What's the state
fixed.
Of that?
That's fixed.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Not by me, but by money and my brother-in-law. God bless him.
You are the busiest man. No one speaks more about the importance of leisure. And I know no one with less time to themselves. I don't think... I got to see you live. I live next to Mark.
Do I speak about the importance? I don't think I've ever done that.
Like, leisure is the basis of culture.
That's Joseph Pieper, not me.
No, you talk about that. You reference him. That's the only reason I know it is from you saying it over and over again.
Leisure might be the basis of culture. I don't know. But jury's out on that. Labor seems to have a lot to do with it. Anyways.
I think I also understand in a greater sense than when I first came here where you and... as a result of knowing you, I sit within the broader Catholic American
my people.
I don't know, tribe is the wrong word.
The people of God in America.
There's a real religious thing here. There's like there's money and there's organizations and there's like. Think tanks and public groups and agitating and like it's a bit this. There's like four right wing thinkers in Australia, and they're either very poor or they're on the hook to a one lady who works in a mining company.
Wow.
And here the landscape is I've met the neocons. I've met the rad trads. Mm-hmm. I've met people doing a very strange, ambiguous dance to just keep everybody happy all of the time. And you really, I think the New Polity thing is very strange and exceptional. And if I can get more people to know about it, I would be very happy.
Great.
So perhaps we could discuss that for a moment.
Newpolity.com.
Well, there we go. We've done it.
It'll get you started, get you finished.
It's very easy to recommend to people. I never quite know what to say. When people are going, what's a good podcast? I say, New Polity. Mm. Less often do people ask me, what's a good magazine or a publishing house?
But if they did.
If they did, I would be ready with an answer. But in the company that I keep, it's often, what's a good podcast?
Yeah. I mean, New Polity is a name for a group of people in Steubenville, Ohio, who really do think that Christ changes everything. Mm. And I don't mean that as a sort of, obviously I hope I don't mean that as like a arrogance, like unlike you losers who don't think it, but you don't, let's be honest, you don't, whoever you are. And I know that cause I don't. Christ changes everything, changes us, changes the possibilities for social order, changes economics, changes politics, everything that is through his grace becomes different. But unfortunately, we live in a liberal society, which takes as one of its premises the idea that there are certain parts of reality for which God is irrelevant, to which God is irrelevant.
Yes.
So God is very relevant to your private sense of peace and well-being, but he is not relevant to politics. God is extremely relevant to belief, as like propositional belief, as you know, the epistemology that you've got going on.
Values.
Yes, but he has nothing to do with money.
Yeah.
So we can understand why we do this. And it's also deliberately done. Like this is a group of men with post-Protestant Reformation in order to avoid the authority of the church made up a particular ideology in which the church is irrelevant to certain factors of life, which just happen to be the factors that matter most to temporal power.
I found myself in the position of defending your position on this.
That's what New Polity is. Just to finish.
All right.
That's the idea, is that because of that difficulty, we need a lot of thought about issues that have, for a long time, simply been thought of as secular.
Yes.
Thought of as godless. Thought of as sort of only extrinsically related to Jesus Christ and his church. And we're trying to, one at a time, with great difficulty and labor, say, let's think about it as Christians.
I think you do a very good job of addressing those things. And there is a subset of the audience that you have, that I assume you meet or write to you from time to time, who will say, this is the sort of New Polity person I have in mind. The person who will say something, oh, they're very good, but not on the money stuff.
Sure.
Or, about the stock market, we have a differing view. Mm-hmm. But I think on that trans stuff, they were saying some very interesting things. You must have had.
Yeah.
You must have encountered.
Yeah, and it goes both ways, too.
But it really, the money thing seems like the central point of difference from another. I don't know anybody else who's arguing the things that you all are arguing there.
Yeah.
That seems to be the really strange, that jumps out as opposed to other journals of post-liberal thought, wherever we may find them.
Yeah.
Compact is not saying, get out of the stock market.
Yeah.
You know, I would like just to dig down into that for a moment, because it annoys me when that happens, because I don't think any of these people that I've had this argument with about have a coherent argument against it, other than, but I have money and it's nice and they need to shut the fuck up and leave me alone with my money.
Yeah, this is the argument from current use, which is, I get this with AI a lot of the time, where I say, well, you know, it seems to me to be fundamentally disordered to relate to a machine as if it's a person. And it seems to follow from that that no machine should be designed to imitate a person and therefore elicit the kind of trust that comes from conversation.
Yes.
And that should just be normal. And what people say is, yes, but look, I used it here to decorate my wall. it's an argument from use. Now, it's interesting because it's like that's not actually a counter argument, but it's an argument that the thing must be good because it feels normal when I do it, right? Which, with technology, it presupposes that the world simply is not a human world. It's a technological world. So we're living amidst a great evolution of technique from nothing to microwaves to AI. And so if I can convincingly say, hey, this is a normal part of this motion, right? This is working. Then that's sufficient to argue that a critique must be wrong. Something similar is happening, I think, with the stock market, where the normalcy of it seems to suffice for evidence that a critique of it cannot be right. If it was so bad, wouldn't I feel weird doing it? Which is fair. And I think there's a, you know, like the, I have to bring up examples to kind of trouble it. I mean, maybe at this point, the easiest example is just to say, you know, I live in Steubenville. It's a very impoverished area and it has very little access to capital, right? And one of the ways that this becomes very obvious is actually in trying to get capital. So I run a grocery store. And one of the chief ways that we've been able to find investors in the grocery store to build a commercial kitchen have been to ask people to stop investing in stocks, to take that money and invest it in building a commercial kitchen. And then they'll receive a return on it, but they're actually enabling something real, something local, something whose value is both in the profits it will produce, but also in the thing itself, right? It's not simply valuable because you can trade it for more money later, the way stocks are. Now, that might be going too fast, but stocks are only valuable as a commodity on a market. So they're valuable insofar as you can buy them low and then sell them higher.
You can have a dividend on many stocks,
that
but I would
true.
Say,
yes.
Certainly on the tech wave of stocks, I don't believe Google has ever managed to pay anybody a dividend.
Sure.
It's an entirely speculatory endeavor.
Yeah. And even dividend, well, yes, I think that's right.
Okay. All right. We don't have to go down that, but you've got something.
Well, dividends are interesting, but I think they ultimately work because they, no, I mean, a dividend just considered as a small share in the profits.
Yes.
Good. Praise God for it. All right. Dividends that are really tiny and ultimately seem to be utilized to incentivize stock ownership, while not in themselves, I think, unreal in the way that I was describing stock ownership, do, I think, fundamentally serve getting people's money into the major corporations of America, getting people's retirement invested into the major powers of our technological overlords. And making sure that it is not put to anything that is directly useful to them and their community.
Yes.
The moment you have a community, the moment you love people around you and want them to flourish, capital loses its abstract quality and it becomes something crying out to be built up and distributed.
We need a swimming pool.
We frickin' need a bar that isn't frightening to the elderly.
I think they should harden up and it's a sick bar.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. They should.
My wife did not love going to that bar. My dad loved it.
No, but this argument is not an argument for why the stock market is bad, but it is an argument rather to show what we are not doing because we're doing stocks. I mean, when you take your labor,
yes,
which you've either inherited, or you take your labor or inherited labor in the form of money, right? You're taking work that people have done in the world or you yourself have done in the world, and then you have a choice to make, right? And when you make the choice to speculatively invest it, I used air quotes, the question of whether speculation, so buying low to sell high later, without increasing opportunities for labor thereby, without increasing labor value in the world thereby, is one question. But then I think there's a more obvious question that people can more readily assent to. So it's that we are neglecting our neighbors.
Yes.
I would feel very similarly, I think, if... I just think that there is a use of our labor for the sake of strangers, rather than as a response to real and concrete needs. And I think that it is normal for people to become investors in, and I use those scare quotes, to become investors to kind of hitch their wagon, as it were, to the success of large multinational firms that make up their retirement funds. And it has become abnormal to give a loan.
Yes.
It has become abnormal to genuinely invest in someone's aspirations, who you know, and for an investment which part of the return of the investment is the existence of the thing that you have helped to create. I mean, we live in such a loveless world, and people are actively invested in things they hate, or at least don't care about. I mean, yeah. No one who's invested in just the standard stock portfolio is there. I mean, some of them do ideologically after I call them on it, but before that, they don't think about Apple. They don't care about Google. They're not there, you know, just experiencing and desiring them to succeed. Very often, the people who are invested in such a manner are apocalyptic doomer people who are kind of waiting for and enjoying to hear about Google collapsing in this way or being disrupted in that way. I mean, and yet their fortunes are tied to them.
I mean, I can think of counterexamples with people who are fanboys for a particular.
That's true.
But this is obscene, I would say. Now, to zoom out one level, which is people love Steubenville who have never been there. I mean, I know several people who are like a shining city on a hill.
Oh, it's not.
It's in a valley.
Yeah, it's geographically quite wrong.
There are elements of it that shine, I would say. But, you know, so you have a... People are investing in a brewery.
Yeah.
In Steubenville.
Well, pledging to invest.
Pledging to invest,
yes,
in a brewery.
We're working on it.
Which I would like to do as well.
Please.
Now, I do not live in Steubenville at the moment.
That's correct.
And also, I know all these people in Australia.
Yeah.
Now, that would be foreign capital.
Oh, yeah. We'll take
for
it.
For a community. Now, see, that's...
Trump, baby, is looking for you.
Now, hold on.
America needs your investment.
But this is... I mean, that's literally international finance for people
absolutely.
That they never know. But they obviously do it with love, and this is they're not going to get the same return that they would get elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, look, I think several things. One is... that if there's a opportunity to help someone in need through giving a loan,
yes,
more locally, then I think you have a certain obligation to do so.
Yeah.
And not invest in something else. Now, if there isn't that opportunity.
Are you saying we should order our loves?
I think we should order our loves. Order them right.
It's heresy.
I mean, the idea of the just man throughout the Old Testament is the one who takes pity and lends. Mm. Now, this is an investment in someone that's motivated out of pity. So the... what makes him just, what makes him worthy of building a statue of him, right, is that he hears a cry of the poor and uses capital, right, for the sake of that poor person. And so throughout the Bible, loaning is not primarily the thing you do to receive a great benefit, right? It's the thing you do in justice, because of the needs of your community.
Yes.
Now, a great difficulty we have is the lack of community, or the lack of ability to invest meaningfully in a community. And I think that's real. That's true. So there is a way in which investing in, you know, things that we are connected to when we don't have closer, more local connections available to us does make sense. But I think that's remedial. I think that's because of a lack of community. It's because of a lack of sometimes the legal possibility of giving loans to help out particular members of your community. I think we live in an odd world.
I mean, no doubt.
and so certain odd things happen.
Aspect.
I think he's a true American because Americans love each other.
Yeah.
Americans would die for each other. That's what constitutes them as a people.
Black people are so good at this and going, that's my community.
They love each other.
I'm going to lift the community up.
Totally.
I'm going to give out 10 pairs of Jordans.
And they probably have what we talked about within Christianity, that kind of light coercion that is proper, I think, to people that love each other, is that you have examples of it going before you. You would feel ashamed to do otherwise. It's a point of honor. It's a point of pride. These are all the things we associate with properly belonging to a people. And then you have our billionaire class, our elite, that seems to think that there's no obligation of, like their success doesn't require a reciprocal turn to the streets and as if they got their language from nowhere, as if they got their abilities from nowhere. I mean, they should they should be shot, James. Anyway.
I'll edit around that for you.
No, yeah.
Are you open about that?
Well, I mean, by, like, after being tried.
Thank you.
Okay.
So long as it's not extrajudicial violence.
No, I would.
I had a bit that wasn't working that I may try and do tonight.
All right.
But it was about this CEO who gets shot by the Italian fella.
Yes, yes.
And all these people are going, huzzah, he's killed the CEO. And I want to say, no, you kill a CEO. That board just hires another CEO at an increased rate to do the same job. You have to kill the board, you know? And if you kill the board, why, what do the shareholders do? They'll elect a board with the very same interest. You have to kill the shareholders, you know? And who are the shareholders? Why, it's that man with a hat, with an app on his phone. We must kill the CEO who lives in our hearts.
That's right.
And people were just quiet, and I stopped saying it. I was very pleased. I thought you might like it.
I do like that. That's really quite good.
Yeah. I was reminded of the Russian folktale about they kill the dragon, and then they come back, and everyone's still afraid of the dragon. Now we just kill the dragon in our heart.
That's beautiful.
A lovely ex-white nationalist told me about that. He really got into Russian folktales for a time. Which, by the way, I did start reading, and they're not appropriate for children.
Oh, boy.
They are so much death, so much violence, very terrifying. Yeah. There's no sense of warmth in the Russian. I forget where we were. I was killing CEOs. You had a call. I think I want to.
We want to wrap up. So
you think very carefully about technology, and I've tried having a dumb phone on the road.
Yeah, that sounds hard.
Getting an Uber. Seems sadly it's a part of my I think I started reading Ivan Illich because of you, and he writes in Tools for Conviviality about the two thresholds, where you have the first threshold where the tool really improves the world, and the second threshold where the world gets worse because of the tool. There's probably a better way to say that, but you know, there's no cars, you get a car, zoom zoom, fantastic. The whole world is built for cars, we're all in traffic.
Right.
I'm very upset.
Yeah.
And this is so with the phone, you know, you get the phone and you go, hey, I can do everything. Wonderful. The world is built for a phone. Hey, guess what? If you don't have a phone, it's harder to tell where you're going. There aren't proper signs anywhere. You can't get a boarding pass on time. There's not a taxi cab to pick you. I just see a guy and say, I'll get in now.
Totally.
And yet, I mean, that Wise phone, I distrust the business model because they're rent seekers, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why that's their business model. It seems evil and wrong. I think I've found a phone that's going to, with no sacrifices, allow me not to just lose myself into the phone forever. I'll let people know if it works. But you're on a different flip phone now.
Yeah, it hasn't gone on me yet, although it is definitely dying in its mechanical kind of way.
You're on the phone a lot. You have a lot of calls.
Literally, yeah.
The battery life on that must be poor.
It is. Often the phone just dies, and that's the end of that. So,
when did you charge the phone today? It feels like when I had a flip phone, I was on the phone a lot. I felt like I was on dialysis. I needed to be plugged in every
Well, I borrowed my brother's car, and he had a little...
You had to charge while driving.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I'd like updates on Steubenville. I may as well do it here.
In public.
I got many of the updates that I saw.
Yeah.
But the mural behind the altar?
Still.
Wow.
Yeah, sorry. It's a personal failure at some point. At some point we have to take responsibility for that one.
Post-mass meals. This was happening...
Yeah,
sometimes, but not all the time. Has it up to? Is it every week now? There's a coffee and donuts.
No, it is monthly.
Okay.
Yeah, and then Lent is an Advent. Are
absent?
Weekly, Advent.
Really?
And not absinthe, Advent.
No, absent. Like but you would think in Lent we give up hanging out with each other.
No, we don't.
Wait, so you get more meals provided during Lent and Advent?
They just don't
have
meat.
Seems liturgically suspect.
They're meatless. No, it is sometimes hard because I'll go to the Friday potluck during Lent, so at the end of fasting.
I love that.
But, boy, people are great cooks. They're making great stuff. It is not a sacrificial experience. Trying everything. And it's always fun because they got these creative, like, we're doing it with chickpeas, you know? We're doing it with fish nuggets.
What about the spirit of Lent? I knew a couple who, they would fast insanely, but then such incredible, weird, you know, this is better food than you were eating, you know, man spent $150 on sun-dried tomatoes to make this weird focaccia. We're eating better than we were before.
Oh, it's like, I mean, that's a tradition too, the Knights of Columbus fish fry.
They love the fish fry.
They love their fish fry. It's an institution.
Post-football game fish fry at the Catholic school. I felt unusual going when I went to the Catholic high school football game, but they were having a fish fry afterwards. And to sit with a bunch of strangers and their children after a 62-0 loss. Who are you? Oh, I've come from Australia. I just wanted to see what's going on. I love kids playing football. I erred on the side of not going. I keep thinking about how to get back to Steubenville.
Well,
and it's really hard with work.
I would imagine it's because we don't have a good comedy club. If you had a comedy club, you could just like book it for, you know, 3 evenings, and then you're making money
throughout the whole year. It's the doing it over and over again is the hard. It helps to get it. I'm finding that it does help to do it on a regular. If you do some, I always hoped that I could just do stand up very little and then be great when it counted. And it turns out that it's good to do a thing over and over again.
Yeah, I know.
Which is devastating. And you can't do it in Pittsburgh. You can do it a little bit in Cleveland.
Yeah.
It's a 4-hour drive back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough.
I hope to one day, at some point, you get worse as a comedian because you're older and people aren't as interested. And then I can move on to something else. It's like being a rock star, I think, where it's, you know, you pass your prime and then it's time to do your next
thing. Yeah.
But I feel shackled to being in one of three American cities at the moment.
Yeah, I get that. Are you ever going to go back to Australia?
I yearn to one day make it back to Australia.
Yeah.
My family would love us to get back to Australia.
I bet, yeah.
And there is some sense in which I am a creature of that soil, and that's where my blood is.
Yeah. That's where people love you without really checking on whether you merit it. That's not true.
It's also where people hate me for not checking whether or not that's merited as well. There are so many things that were novel about being in America that I now consider sort of non-negotiables, and I'm very angry that they exist. But this is the corrupting influence of the immigrant. Yeah. No one should immigrate.
Yeah.
Immigrate? Sure. No, there should be no emigres. It's an act of violence, and I'm opposed to it. But I've obviously loved it. But as I come to love America more, I come to hate things about my own country.
I see.
The bureaucracy is nightmarish. And there's no real sense that I could change that.
Right.
The cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
The expense. The $1 million for a bad house. The thought that I would have to get a mortgage, which I don't want. I don't want a mortgage. I mean, is a mortgage a lesser ill than renting?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, totally.
Better to buy outright.
Yeah,
I would think.
Buy the thing, but if you can.
But I'm participating in usury.
Yeah, but you know, you got to make good use of another man's sin, as Aquinas says.
Should I not draw him into a near occasion of sin? Does not
it's
the
not
harlot
a near occasion? He's already.
He is sinning. Yeah.
Dang.
I mean, am I sinning by entering into a usurious relationship where I'm being ripped off?
No. I mean, no.
Say that loudly so my wife can hear it. You'll back her up on this one.
No.
I was saying it was.
No, it's not. I mean, there are a few questions that Aquinas really takes directly, but that's one of them, about entering into a usurious contract. And he says it's not the fault of the person who needs it. It's the fault of the person charging interest on the loan.
Need is a
need is a tough one, but I think people need houses.
I need my ships to go to the new world and bring back fine spices.
You're right. I think that there are some occasions at which it doesn't quite make sense.
But I do need a house.
You do need a house.
Dang. My credit's just recovered in Australia.
Oh, that's great.
I was defaulted on some credit card things, and I... Which I would recommend for everybody who's in their 20s. Get what you can get. I mean, when they were calling me trying to get their money back, You have, in Australia, it works like this. You start out with perfect credit,
yeah,
or, you know, good credit,
yeah,
and then you you get into trouble with the credit, and they go, for 7 years, there's a blot against your name, uh-huh, and then you are completely back,
oh, wow,
to where you were. So this late, I was, you know, whatever. I was just before the birth of my first child, and I was... I had absolutely no money or prospects, and there's this lady at the rent collection place going, please, you don't want bad credit. And I go, I don't hire. I mean, I'm not going to get another credit card. I've learned my lesson. She goes, but what if you want to buy a house? I go, I don't think I could buy a house in the next 7 years. And she goes, and then she starts to lift me up. She starts to go, you don't know what you're capable of doing. You can do anything you set your mind to. One of my better financial, if I had gone into that planning to defraud someone,
yeah,
terrible.
Sure.
To extricate yourself from a bad situation like that is, yeah, I think I'm fairly happy. They ended up getting some money from me. I don't know, excuse me. But now anyway, it's an option.
Sure.
I have to at some point I seek your counsel on this, and I maybe better done privately, but why not? People are backing the career, they're invested.
All right.
At what point do you go? And I suspect the answer will be at no point, and that it's all been a huge mistake.
Okay.
But at what point do you go, I've gone away, I've done the work, I've reaped this, I've climbed the ladder, I've captured this way. I don't like that. It's a horrible thing to think of oneself as like working, just to profit, mm-hmm, you know, so that you can move that over somewhere else. I see this, corporations do this all the time, and it's terrible. It doesn't actually work out. In my line of work, I don't think I've had a choice, but everyone has a choice. But I've had an ability to travel,
mm-hmm,
and to make money and to grow some sort of career thing from it. And that could go on interminably. But at some point you can go, that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
I return to something. Or you go, there is no end to that. Mm-hmm. Or you call it too soon, or you call it too late. You've done damage to yourself. Or, yeah. I don't know how to prudentially make this decision. And I feel... adrift.
Mm.
People in Adelaide, they people close to me just want me back,
mm-hmm,
which is very nice. People in America just want me here.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to be able to provide for my family. What that looks, I mean, does your family need a beautiful leather couch and a fine Volkswagen? I mean, what is the level of material provision? It's very rare to get that choice to say, how much should I be providing for my family? What am I willing to do? You know, usually either you have to work too much or too little, and you don't actually get to decide how much you end up doing.
Yeah, sure, sure, sure.
But I have no, I am totally adrift on this.
Well, I think you're right to try and look for a limit that you could reasonably determine with your family, with your wife, because it's like, it's sort of the first step. If you simply say, I mean, if you just start this route of like, it is... the idea of like a limitless, you know, I do everything for my family, right?
Can, yes,
very quickly become, I never see my family because I'm doing everything for my family.
Yes.
And then it's like, well, you're doing nothing for your family, in fact. So, you know, you avoid that trap by saying like, well, no, let's determine what the family needs me to do. But I think that's a question.
I mean, this is infinite. This is a difficult, it's infinite, right? I mean, there's no amount of time I wouldn't like to be spending with my children.
Well.
And I don't think there's an amount of time that I could be spending with my wife and children that I'd go... I mean, sometimes, yeah, you go, I need to go for a walk because this house is very loud. Mm-hmm. But this is a cudgel that everybody could take to their conscience that I don't get to spend enough. I mean, a man must... It is right for a man to work.
But I think part... Yes, it is. And it's also right to have a community that transcends the family.
Yes.
Right? Our hearts long for that. The family is a intense love, but it, by its nature, produces a desire to expand itself, the kind of love that's experienced in the family, outside of itself. It's a fruitful thing. And so this idea of like, it's part of the problem with the modern world that you're facing is that there isn't community out there, and so work becomes guiltily set against family life, mm, instead of family having a natural transcendence into the greater community, so that you're always making a choice between family and then
a work-life balance.
Yeah, but like where life is like, but where life doesn't involve the family. I mean, maybe the best way to, is just to explain it. It's like I have a luxury because there's a strong community in Steubenville that many people don't experience, which is that there are many times where I get to leave the family to work on what I know my family wants to receive in the community itself, not yes. just abstractly as money that gets translated into consumer
goods. They get nicer groceries.
Right. Like they get a place to go. They get a place to walk. They get and it's a place that I'm like to serve the city, to serve the community in which the kids are growing up is also to be with the children in that sense of like, I'm gone, I'm preparing a place for you. And I think Jesus said that, didn't he? The family needs to transcend itself. Like it needs to have a larger thing into which it's growing.
Yes.
I think part of the difficulty is that it very often doesn't. It's a smaller, paltry money world that it's not growing into. Instead, it's sending people out to go grab from it and bring back.
Yes.
Which is an unfortunate and unnatural way of being. So I'm not giving you advice. I'm giving you sympathy.
No, I... Well, look, I... I mean, we are sent out into the... we're sent out into the world. It would be easier if I were an evangelical mm-hmm. and I thought my work... ordained by God. I mean, creatively, and maybe this is a lack of imagination on my part, I just don't believe that he needs stand up. You know? I can't see it. And there'll be evangelical friends who are like, all these incredible things are happening in your career. God wants that for... And I go, I don't know. I don't see it. I don't hear it. I try not to say anything particularly scandalous against my faith or that I wouldn't agree with. And I think people have a right to go and to pay money and see a show that makes them feel happier. That's a nice thing to be able to do. That's mm-hmm. I think we don't believe that theaters should be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
But like me specifically doing the jokes, I think the world goes on just fine. Without sure. that, I can't see that this is...
I think sometimes we get scared of how free human freedom really is. Like, we can just do things.
Yeah.
And so we look for the sanction of God's providence, not because we genuinely think that there is a particular calling, but because we're scared that what we're doing is, in fact, free. Like, we are making it up. We're going out yes. there and doing stuff. And I find that there's a way of thinking about it that can, I suppose, be a little bit atheistic, right? Which is that there's this realm in which God doesn't really care, right? But I don't think that's the only possibility. I think there's also the possibility of realizing that God loves your freedom. He loves mankind so much that he's given them a gift of doing what they will.
Yeah.
And that's very hard for us because we want to do the will of God, but the will of God includes our creativity.
Personal freedom and creativity, yeah.
So it's very paradoxical. But it seems to me like the answer is somewhere in this direction. Like, and I've had this thought before. It's like, you know, I'll often end up doing things that I just love doing, knowing full well that I'm immensely and probably preferably replaceable in the doing of it.
Yeah.
You know, like,
but you can delight in it and you can give thanks for it.
Right. And I think that's important too.
And giving thanks as opposed to, I mean,
but
I think
not, it's not, you don't want to functionalize it, right?
Well, if the work is ordained, if you have to go and do the creative work that God wants you to do, then you well, how can you give thanks for that? You get a pat on the head for having done a good sure. job, but you're not delighting in creation and a godlike activity.
Yeah. I mean, there's that part in the book of Samuel where Saul, who admittedly an ambiguous character by all accounts, is anointed by Samuel, and Samuel tells him, go and do what you will, for the Lord is with you. Now, this is a terrifying but delightful thought. Can you imagine the kind of feeling of liberation that my will, you know, sort of has a sanction? Like I can just go do what I want. What he actually has yeah. been doing is dancing and singing with the prophets. It's a very obscure...
That's beautiful.
I'm not sure what it all means, to be frank. But I think it's what...
You know, he dances and sings. It's what you do with your freedom. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And I think that's something that that we can forget, which is that when we say something like, God is with me, What we often mean is I have a didactic sanction of a plan I made up. And the thing I'm doing, you shall not question because God is with me.
Yeah.
In actual fact, it seems like when God is with you, you are liberated into a space of creative freedom. Like, you don't have to worry about whether you're doing the right thing anymore because you're in a conformity with him already.
Yes.
It seems to me that Christianity is a great defender of doing things on the basis of vibes, feeling it.
Yeah.
You're good at it, so do it. Don't overthink it.
I mean, this is within a culturated framework. I think that's easier because it's harder to get lost in... we are concupiscent.
Yep.
And it's very easy for the world then to to love and do as you will. Okay. But do not love immoderately. Do not love excessively. Sure. Do not love, to the pure. All is pure.
Yeah.
But really, who's that?
Yeah. Right.
So that is then, to be in that world is... I mean, there's no answer here easily. What you've said is very beautiful, and I appreciate it. And that will buoy me in the
days
to come. But it is, I do have to figure that out.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that your conscience will guide you, my son.
I think my conscience might guide me to it's a beautiful Olympic-sized swimming pool, and that I, with great generosity, allow my friends and neighbors to participate.
You really are. You're becoming an American. This is a marvelous transformation. That idea of, like, I will receive everything that the world has to offer, but as a blessing, is like peak Americana. Look at how the Lord has blessed my bank account.
Lord, it's really sick and weird. I think this is... I mean, it was easier for me to tell if I was with the vibe that I was on the right road because of the suffering. I continue to suffer in different ways. Yeah. But for a while there, which you got to witness, strange material. Why am I here? What's going on? What choices have I made?
Yeah.
This is agony. And then great, beautiful epiphanies as a result. I mean, I don't think I'll never be able to... some success and comfort. To have that given is a great gift.
Mm-hmm.
To choose something recklessly and to throw your family into a bizarre situation where you don't know what you're going to do. That's being a bad father, I think. If it happens and you respond as best you can, what a beautiful opportunity for struggle and taking up a cross and these sorts of things. But to then go, we're doing it. We're doing it now. Where does the Holy Spirit start and a manic episode end?
Oh, man. That's another great American question. You know, it's like you are to take up your cross, but you're not supposed to crucify your children. So there's this.
That's great. Is that yours?
Yeah, I was just thinking about it. Filipinos
literally do
sometimes disagree with this at a certain level. No, I mean, they're doing it themselves too. I believe actually that's the Filipino tradition, which I shouldn't say. I mean, I know it's contested there. I think the bishops are against it, et cetera. But it is
so cool.
I have to say, there's this thing that happens where everyone is like, "Oh yeah, that's they don't understand Christianity. That's it, taking it. They don't like it's wrong," but it's like, yeah, that's extremely manly.
Yeah, there was this Jewish comedian named John Safran who, at the end of one of his shows, his series, he went and did it. He went to the Philippines and was crucified. He was always doing strange things, but I forget the context of it, and I think it may have just been a cool thing to close the show, but it was about him like feeling bad about being Jewish and being interested in non-Jewish women and being constrained by his Jewishness. And then at the end, he goes and gets himself crucified. And they really drive nails through his hands.
Yeah. Well, I guess,
it's great footage. I don't remember. I wish I could remember the point. I think he probably started out by going, wouldn't it be cool if the show ended? I've heard they're crucifying people in the Philippines.
Right.
Wouldn't it be nice to go and do that? Wouldn't that be a cool end to the show? And then probably justified that. in reverse. Yeah. But I bet that as you're getting closer and closer to the nail coming into the hand, you think this might not be.
Yeah.
Oh, it stayed with me. We have dinner.
Yeah,
we have dinner.
All right, James, thanks for having me on your podcast.
A heavily edited podcast to come.
All right. God bless. Bye.